And please welcome Mr. Glenn Stevens.
Thank you very much, Richard. And Chancellor, Vice-Chancellor, Pro-Vice-Chancellor, other distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here in sunny Townsville. It is indeed first time I've had the pleasure of coming here, but I hope very much not the last. Townsville and its surrounding region boasts, of course, a significant set of industries. A port and refining capacity for important parts of the mining sector, an export point for a number of agricultural industries, an access point for tourists to the Barrier Reef, a home to research on the marine environment. It's the base for an important part of Australia's defence capability. And, of course, the university itself is an important centre for higher education, and indeed a number of university graduates from here I've had the pleasure of working with over the years, and some of them have become quite prominent in the fields of finance and business. So it's a pleasure to be here to talk about how economic conditions are unfolding, including in countries and industries in which this region has more than a passing interest. A month or so back, the Reserve Bank released our May statement on monetary policy. Now, I could ask for a show of hands as to who's read that. I'm going to assume that not too many people here will have. If you're having trouble sleeping at night, you may find it helpful. But what I'd like to do is to give an update on the views in that, although most things which have occurred since haven't caused us greatly to change our views. But I'd like to give an update there and draw out, I think, what I think are a couple of interesting features as to what's happening. Let me begin with the global economy. It's been widely remarked that the current global recession is the deepest one since World War II. I think there's little debate now about that description. It's not necessarily the case, however, that it will be the biggest recession for every individual economy. It will be for quite a few, but a number of countries have actually seen larger recessions in the past than they seem to be having now. For a number of countries in Asia and Latin America, other downturns, which happened for other reasons, were probably more damaging than what we're seeing now. And I don't think it will be the biggest post-war recession in Australia either, though, of course, we won't know for sure for a while yet, one way or the other. But it's the exceptional synchronicity, the high correlation between countries, which actually is the striking feature of this international downturn. It's well known, of course, that, and it's often been remarked, that the genesis of the crisis, or the financial crisis, had its origin in lax lending standards in some of the major countries, particularly the United States, and cheap credit more generally around the global financial system. And that's been talked about at length before, so I won't go over that. What I want to do is to talk instead about the sharp deterioration in demand for goods and services that we saw around the world as a result of the financial turbulence late last year. There are some features of that event which I think help us understand both our own experience to date and how that compares with other countries. Now, historians will study all this for decades. There's a lot of PhD theses, no doubt some of them at James Cook University, to be written about the events of last September and October and what's unfolded since. But I think it's clear that a trigger for the collapse in demand that we've seen around the world was the heightening of stress in financial markets. We had a sequence of extraordinary events over the course of about 6 weeks from middle September to the end of October. We had the US government taking over the two largest participants in housing finance in that country. We had the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, one of the four at that point remaining American investment banks, which I think everybody had assumed was too big to fail or too big to be allowed to fail, and yet it did fail. We had the US government essentially taking over one of the world's largest insurance companies. We had, in short order, pressure on systemically important financial institutions across the US and across Europe. Combined, that previously almost unthinkable sequence of events resulted in a sharp increase in perceived systemic risk in financial institutions and financial markets right around the world. Stock prices fell sharply. They fell by about a quarter in the space of a month. Risk pricing on all sorts of debt instruments exploded. And capital markets for issuing or rolling over new debt and equity essentially closed for a period of time. That was the most turbulent period in international finance that any current banker or economist or market trader or policymaker has ever lived through, and we hope ever will. Unlike most previous crises, moreover, the news about this set of events reached people all over the world very quickly. They didn't learn about it the way they once might have through delayed print media, highbrow publications, word of mouth, and so on. Instead, they learned about it simultaneously through the 24-hour news cycle, more or less in real time and more or less at the same time everywhere. In the face of that acute uncertainty, firms and households everywhere did what you would expect them to do in that situation. That is, they acted in a precautionary way. They postponed discretionary purchases, they shelved expansion plans, and they set about doing whatever they could to strengthen their financial position, their balance sheet, by getting their debt down. The result of that was the highly synchronized slump in demand, especially for consumer durables and investment goods. It's true that production and consumption of more everyday things, services and non-durables, also fell, but by a lot less than demand for anything that you could decide to buy tomorrow rather than today. And the nature of that helps us to understand the relative performance of various countries subsequently. It's become much clearer that the countries who've been most badly affected by what's occurred, it turns out, isn't the United States. The countries most badly affected are those who specialise in the production and export of these high-value consumer durables and investment goods. So countries like Japan and Germany, amongst the advanced countries, have had the biggest contraction in their economies in the past 6 months. Among emerging market economies, some of the biggest contractions have been among some of the Asian countries who are part of the production chain for some of these consumer durables. Well, if the fall in global demand late in 2008 was rapid, the cut in production was even more aggressive as firms sought to reduce their inventories of unsold products. In many countries, these inventories or stocks had been tending to rise anyway going into the crisis, and then firms were faced with the likelihood of a further pickup in stocks as demand for the products fell away. And at the same time, the cost of funding those inventories through borrowing was, of course, going up. So firms sought to get inventories down very quickly as part of their strategy of battening down the hatches to survive the downturn. To achieve a reduction in inventories, of course, firms must cut production by more than demand has fallen, so that you get production below demand, and inventories will then fall. And that's indeed what seems to have occurred in many cases. Once you've got stocks under control, of course, then production can come back up to wherever it is that demand is running at. And that's what we're seeing now, actually, in a number of countries, particularly around Asia. Industrial production has risen quite sharply over the past few months in quite a number of these countries. And in some cases, it's retraced most of, and in one or two cases, all of, the earlier fall. The clearest sign of that is in China, where, as we estimated, industrial production had recovered all its losses by March of this year. China doesn't publish quarterly GDP growth data, but we have a go at backing out what we think the quarter was from what they do publish. And as best we can tell, the March quarter growth rate picked up relative to the quite weak result in the December quarter. The improvement in conditions in some other countries in Asia probably owes quite a bit to this strengthening in China. Quite a marked bounce in industrial production has happened, for example, in Korea and Taiwan, and a similar pattern looks to be emerging in several other countries around the region. Even Japan's production is now starting to rise, albeit from an exceptionally weak situation. Japanese production of industrial products gave up 25 years of growth in 6 months between about October and March. It's now starting to pick up very gradually from that. Across the leading countries, the major countries, the pickup isn't really that clear at all. And in fact, the best we can say at this stage is that it looks like the pace of contraction is now starting to slow down quite noticeably. But that's about all we can say. Now, while the initial pickup in output in a number of countries is occurring because this inventory cycle is turning the corner, that, as I said before, only lifts production back up to the level of demand. For production to keep rising, of course, we need demand to start increasing. So the question is whether that's occurring. The clearest evidence for that, again, is in some of the emerging countries, including in particular China. China's pickup in output does not seem to be being driven at the moment by exports to the developed world, which haven't really risen at all. It seems to be being driven by stronger Chinese local demand at home. I think the reversal of earlier restrictive policies in China that they had in place to try to control inflation, plus a government stimulus package in that country, which by any standard anywhere is a very large one, have made a major contribution to this turnaround. To date, the recovery has been led by increased spending on infrastructure, including public spending. It isn't yet clear the extent to which Chinese private household demand is starting to pick up, and of course that will be important as we go forward. Well, the pickup in China is beneficial to Australia, and I'll come back to that in a minute. It'll also be beneficial if the emerging world generally relies more on demand at home for its growth in the years ahead than on exports to the developed world as they used to. A durable expansion globally is going to be one where it's more balanced between the developing world and the developed world than the one we had until a couple of years ago. Having said that, prospects for demand in the developed world obviously remain very important because it's still the case that the US, Europe and Japan and these countries are so large that they still weigh very much, they still have about the bulk of the world economy. Most observers expect that demand in these countries will be quite subdued for a few years. Now, you might ask, of course, whether the striking speed and simultaneity of the downturn that we saw late last year might be matched in the upturn. That's a logical question to ask. The reason that most people think it won't be is that the loss of wealth to households via lower stock prices, lower housing prices and so on during 2008 and the need for private sector balance sheets to be de-geared, de-leveraged over the years ahead, that those things will constrain household demand and constrain the ability of the banking system to expand credit, and that for those reasons, therefore, the pickup in aggregate demand in these countries over the next couple of years will be a pretty modest one. And I think that's a reasonable reading of the history of financial crises of this type as we look back in past experience. So it's likely that global growth, when it resumes, will be initially at least modest. Just one thought to add to that, though, and that is that the speed and size of the responses to the downturn by policymakers around the world was every bit as rapid and as synchronised as the downturn itself. So if there was a surprise on the upside for global growth, if it turned out that things ended up stronger than expected, if that happened, I think most likely that would be because the collective effects of those they're not really coordinated stimulus movements, but they're certainly consistent and rather simultaneous. The collective effects of those could turn out to be bigger than currently expected. And after all, the expectations that people have are really based on a history, looking at history, and this kind of simultaneous policy action hasn't really occurred very often in that history. So in that sense, the history might not be the best guide. Having said all that, it is surely the case that the build-up in government debt in a number of countries is going to constrain their room for manoeuvre over the years ahead. Now, let me be very clear here, and this is in bold in the printed text, I'm not talking about Australia here in terms of debt and those things. Rather, I have in mind countries where public debt will reach the equivalent of 100% of their annual GDP, and there are a number of countries where that will occur over the next few years. Now, it isn't that those magnitudes are completely unprecedented. It isn't that those magnitudes are totally unmanageable. But it will constrain the policy choices available to those countries by a much greater amount than they've been accustomed to for quite a long time. If there was to be another global recession in another 6 or 7 years, for example, a number of these countries, I think, would find that they would not be able to use expansionary fiscal measures to help support their economy in that event. So that, I think, is an issue which will grow in prominence as we go forward in a number of the major countries around the world. Well, let me turn to Australia. The developments in the world economy, of course, have had a significant effect on our economy. One channel has been the impact on commodity prices, where prices have fallen sharply in the second half of last year, having, of course, risen very strongly prior to that. It's been apparent for some time that developments in the markets for coal and iron ore suggested that there would be a large reduction in the new contract prices in those commodities when the contracts were renegotiated, and that's indeed now happened, and there has been a significant fall in contract prices for those commodities for the current year. So compared with last year, a lot less revenue will be coming in. But it's important to remember that commodity prices remain quite high by historical standards, even with this fall. Even with a fall of 45 to 60% for coal prices and 35-odd% for iron ore, the 2009-10 prices, they're not the highest on record anymore, they're the second highest. 5 or 6 years ago, these sorts of prices would have been seen as extraordinary. And I think as the outlook for resources demand becomes clearer, and as the uncertainty in financial markets gradually abates, as it seems to be doing, it wouldn't be surprising if plans for some mining projects which are presently being put on hold were reactivated. Even if that occurs, of course, it'll take some time for those projects to get up and running. But nonetheless, I think that might in due course occur. The volume of Australia's exports, moreover, has held up, that is the tonnages, has held up remarkably well so far. even people who were relatively optimistic, as I was, have been, I think, a little surprised by just how strong this is. I thought I would quote to you, in the printed version of this talk, there's a table that shows the rate of growth of exports in real terms over the 6 months to the March quarter by country. Let me just read to you a few of these numbers. So this is March compared with September, the six-month growth rate for exports in real terms. Japan, -37%. Taiwan, -24%. Singapore, -20%. China, -18%. Germany, -17%. United States, -14%. The best of the majors is the UK, -10%. The number for Australia, +2%. We've had a better farm season, so we could take that out and just do non-farm, in which case the figure is -0.4%, so essentially zero. So there you've got Australia's exports to date, at least, flat, whereas most other countries you can think of as a double-digit decline over the last 6 months. Now, as I've said, there are some supply-side factors which help that. A larger wheat crop, and there's an additional LNG train coming on stream that is also helping. But there are some interesting patterns here in the demand for the key commodities for Australia. Let me talk a little bit about those. A large proportion of our iron ore goes to China. Very little of it goes to Europe. As it turns out, demand in China has picked up, whereas demand in Europe has gone down. The Chinese demand is increasing as infrastructure spending picks up, of course. In the coal market, Australia's exports traditionally were to Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and demand has softened in those countries. But China's demand for coal has increased and has partly offset those falls in those other places. Indeed, in the past year, China's share of Australia's merchandise exports has risen very sharply, and it's almost as great as Japan, who for 30 years has been our largest single trading partner. Most likely, I guess, China will overtake Japan before much longer. Now, part of the increase in demand from China is explained by the construction activity taking place there. Part of it's also reduced Chinese production of iron ore and coal, because at lower prices, a number of the mines up there are not economic, and so they're shutting down. Australia's miners, of course, are very low-cost producers globally, so they benefit when these higher-cost producers shut up shop. So factors like that have, at least so far, kept Australia's exports doing pretty well, and I think they offer significant long-term opportunities, including for this region here. The economy has nonetheless been affected by the global recession. Real GDP in net terms over the last two quarters has actually gone down a bit. Not a lot, but down just a little. The major driver of the slowdown has been weaker private domestic demand at home. Obviously, exports, as I've just said, are going ahead pretty well. And quite prominent in that lower domestic spending is a very large fall in business investment spending, fixed capital investment. I think that's best seen as the same precautionary behaviour, understandably, by businesses here, as we see on the part of all their counterparts everywhere else in the world. In fact, it's a pretty standard result that in the latest quarter, the March quarter, for which we have data, business investment has fallen around 8 to 10% in that quarter, which is a very large quarterly fall, in almost every country you can think of. And Australia has about the same outcome. So macroeconomic policies haven't been able to prevent a downturn at all. And indeed, they rarely can, particularly in the face of a global recession of this size. And in fact, attempts to do so, as often as not, tend to run into problems down the track. But it is, I think, feasible to think that macroeconomic policies can make the downturn less deep than it would have otherwise been. and that they can help establish conditions for recovery for a new expansion getting underway a bit later on. Of course, to implement expansionary changes as we have, both fiscal and monetary, in this period, you have to earn the scope to do that by running prudent, tight policies during the upswing part of the cycle. But we did do that. So we had scope to run a more expansionary setting as the global recession hit, and we've used that scope. So what is it the Reserve Bank's been doing? Well, we made a number of changes to our financial market operations, and a lot of these things are actually not on the radar for most of the population. They're more for the aficionados. But those things to keep markets functioning properly in an environment where globally financial markets were incredibly distressed, they were quite important in just helping our financial system cope with the shock of what was going on. Measures that the government took in this sphere were also important. And here I have in mind the various guarantees that they brought in, including in particular the guarantee available to assist banks in accessing offshore capital markets for a price. The Reserve Bank Board also moved quickly to ease monetary policy after the events of mid-September. Interest rates reduced quite quickly. And at 3%, our overnight rate is the lowest it's been since the early 1960s. That has fed through into significant declines in the rates paid by borrowers, especially but not only households. The debt servicing costs of households in particular, as a share of their income, has fallen further and faster in the last 8 or 9 months than ever before in our modern history. Now, we haven't felt the need to cut our policy rate to zero, which is pretty much where the corresponding rate is in America or England or Japan or Switzerland, Canada. The European Central Bank is at 1%, so they're not far above zero. We haven't felt the need to do that, and there are two reasons. The first is that the economic situation we face is not as dire as in those countries, as I think is increasingly clear as the figures come out. And the second is that the effects on borrowers and borrowing costs of the rate reductions we have done have actually been more direct and more powerful, I think, than in a number of those other countries. The combined impact of the easing of fiscal and monetary policy is likely to have been substantial. Quantification of those effects is very much a matter of judgment, I think. Nonetheless, the fact that Australia is experiencing so far a smaller downturn, considerably smaller than most other countries, I think is consistent with the idea that these policies have made a difference. It's true that the financial excesses that other countries had, we didn't have them, and we always felt that that was going to be a very strong point for Australia, and I think that's turning out to be so. And we have the good fortune of the exposure to China, which other countries don't have in the same way. Nonetheless, I think significant macroeconomic policy responses have played a role. The fiscal initiatives were sizable by global standards and they were quite quickly implemented. And as I said, the monetary policy impact we think was quite strong in terms of reducing debt servicing costs and helping people restructure their balance sheets and get their leverage down. I think the relevant question now is, what are the prospects for a durable new expansion, both globally and here in Australia? It's likely, I think, that economic activity has stayed fairly subdued in the June quarter. That's the quarter we're in now. The rapid decline in business investment spending almost certainly is continuing. Consumer spending's, in fact, held up pretty well so far in Australia, but it could be weaker for a few months ahead after the effects of the one-time payments that the government's made fade out. And as higher unemployment starts to weigh on income and starts to affect willingness to spend. So consumers might be a bit weaker in the next 6 months than they've been in the past six. On the other hand, we are likely to see a significant growth in public spending over the year ahead resulting from fiscal policy decisions. And while it will be a while yet before we see in the data the effects on housing construction of lower interest rates and the homeowners grant and so on. There are things happening in terms of the early leading indicators there that should be happening about now if we're to see a turn up in that sector later in the year. So overall then, our expectation remains that the economy will be well placed for a new expansion towards the end of this year. Initially, it will be fairly gradual, mainly because of the global picture that I painted earlier. If it is gradual, then that will mean that spare capacity in the economy will tend to increase for a while. That is, our demand won't grow fast enough to unwind the spare capacity that we have. And if that's the case, that would mean that inflation probably would tend to keep declining for a while, even after the economy begins to grow again. That in turn means, as we said on Tuesday, that some scope remains to ease monetary policy a bit further, because inflation's falling, if that were to be helpful for bringing about a durable expansion. Now, the emphasis on durable is important in that statement. It is, of course, the intention of the low interest rates we have at the moment to lower debt servicing costs, to make it easier for people to reduce their debt and to support aggregate demand. It would be counterproductive, though, if further reductions in interest rates simply managed to induce a large number of marginal borrowers into debt that they could only afford to service at unusually low rates. That would be not a good thing. And that's a reason for care on our part and also on the part of private lenders. And I note that it is the case that the private banks are starting to just be a little bit more careful with their lending conditions to households for this very reason. Well, picking cyclical turning points, which is what we're talking about here, is notoriously hard. It's hard even in hindsight, frankly, let alone ahead of time. But I think Australia is as well positioned as any country, and better than most, to take part in a new expansion beginning later in the year. Longer term, there's also plenty to be positive about, I think. There are good grounds to think that we can emerge from the current global recession with our economy largely free of the problems in the financial system, the strains on public sector balance sheets, government budgets, and free of the general sense of disillusion that I think a lot of these countries feel at the moment. So we'll be free of that. If we keep to prudent policy frameworks and settings, if we maintain flexibility, if we keep a focus on productivity, and if we keep pursuing the opportunities from the engagement with Asia, then we can have a prosperous future. And I think this part of Australia here is as well placed as any to take its part, your part, in that prosperous future. Thank you very much for your attention.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed your lunch and still enjoying your lunch. Please do so. As is traditional at the at these best afternoons and breakfasts we used to have last year, there's a question and answer session, and you're invited to ask questions. I'll just start off with a couple. I won't talk about football because that's been canvassed already. But what is your favourite team?
Well, I've got to say Sharks, because that's where I live.
Sharks, okay, that's all right.
I didn't hear that.
That's not Martin Place.
No.
Well, this morning I read on the front page of the Australian newspaper that although technically we're not in a recession, the economy is in an actual recession by just about every other measure than the gross domestic product number. What are we to believe?
Well, I think the commonly used so-called technical definition, it was always a shorthand anyway for for a somewhat more sophisticated way of thinking about this. In the United States, there's an actual committee of wise economists that sit as a panel and determine what the dates of the business cycle are, long after the cycle's over, actually. And it turns out that historically, the dates that they chose happened to coincide with there having been two successive contractions in real GDP in the US. So that became a sort of a shorthand, but it isn't really, I don't think, a satisfactory definition on its own. It's always been a shorthand. I think for most people out there who are in business, it's certainly felt like a recession for some months now, and I think that would be their conclusion. Whether you call it technical or not doesn't really matter in that sense. I think the important thing is that it's not at this point looking like a terribly deep event, unlike the case in a number of other countries, and that's good.
Yeah. We're sort of confronted with this mixed commentary on a daily basis, depending on who you listen to or read about. In these circumstances, you mentioned the leadership of the RBA over the past few months. What sort of continuing leadership should Australians look to you for, or look to the RBA for?
Our main job is to preserve as much as we can the stability of our currency. Our legislation has three components: stability of the currency, by which we mean the stability of its purchasing power, so controlling inflation; full employment, by which we mean keeping the economy running as close as we can to its potential output path; and the third one is a more general one, the prosperity and welfare of the Australian people, which is harder to kind of quantify, but they're our goals, and what people can expect of us is to do our job every day in pursuit of those objectives as we go forward.
Yeah, well, but when governments change, and they do reasonably frequently, the global financial circumstances change, as it has dramatically just recently, there normally follows a substantial change or shift in fiscal policy. How does the RBA maintain a sort of a steady monetary policy strategy with all that going on?
The important thing is to be clear about what your goals are, because your goals don't change. What changes, and has changed quite quickly in the past 6 months, is where you set your instrument in pursuit of the goal. But the goal is a medium-term inflation target, 2-3% on average, which helps us manage both the business cycle, employment, unemployment, real GDP and so on, and the inflation dimension. We can accommodate those in a reasonably balanced way within our target, and we move our instrument, which is the overnight interest rate, in pursuit of that set of objectives. The objectives are steady. They haven't changed for 20 years. And what changes is the instrument we set according to how we think things are going relative to our goals. So the steadiness is, I think, in the continued pursuit of the same goal, varying the interest rate as best we can to achieve that goal.
Yeah. Well, after this next one, we'll, if you'd like to ask the Governor a question, would you please indicate by raising your hand? And we've got two lovely young ladies that have got radio mics to race over to where you put your hand up, and we'll organise that shortly. Just a quick one before that happens. Please do so now if you'd like to ask a question. Do you think the USA economic situation will follow what happened in Japan sort of 15 years or so ago? And if so, what would be the impact on the world economy and on Australia in particular?
Well, it would be very bad for the world economy if that occurred. Japan's experience was that they took a very long time to come to grips with the problems in their banking system. And that problem was like a
a very corrosive effect on the Japanese economy for that very long period. And so they talk about the lost decade. Now, I don't think I don't think the Americans will take so long. I think they are moving forward quite quickly, actually, on the various things that need to be done to sort out the financial system. It still isn't going to be the case that they will bounce back to rapid growth quickly, I don't think, but I'd say that the prospects of a very long period of lost opportunity in America being the way they are, I don't think that that will happen. But they certainly face a very big problem, and they've got to keep working hard to fix that.
Well, Japan's sort of going through that sort of a semi-period like that again at the moment, isn't it?
Well, the banking system there, I don't think, is in the same trouble that it was after the bubble burst in the early 90s. I think Japan's bigger problem now is, as I said earlier, it's the specialisation in the manufacture and export of these particular products for which the demand has fallen so far. That's making life very hard for them. I think it's that rather than the financial system per se that's their problem at the moment.
Yeah, my bedtime reading at the moment is about the collapse of Bear Stearns. And I was just wondering, it collapsed and was sort of offloaded to J.P. Morgan's. And then Lehman Brothers came along and the government sort of didn't step in and have conferences about that, it just let it fail, is it?
I think you'll find eventually when the history is written that there were lots of conferences and meetings about how to handle that. But as best I can tell from my conversations with my counterparts around the world, I don't think they could find a mechanism that they could legally use to arrange a rescue for Lehman Brothers in the way that it was possible in the Bear Stearns case. Mm. I think they would have found a way of rescuing it if that had been possible, but I don't think it was legally possible.
You've got the United States government now a major shareholder in so many organisations.
Indeed, you do. But at the time Lehman failed, I don't think they had the legal power to do that. That came in subsequently.
We have a question down this end, please.
Yes, thank you very much. My name's Michael Croker and I'm with a company called Business in Balance. Mr. Stevens, there have been a number of material indicators that we've read about and seen in the media since September of last year that indicate objective measures of a decline in our economic environment. My question for you today is clearly a big part of what we've all experienced since September last year has been driven by what I could refer to as a decline in confidence overall. Two-part question. Firstly, how important is that confidence factor in your role in as Governor of the Reserve Bank? And the second part of the question is, what might we look forward to or expect as perhaps a tipping point at which we might see an improvement in that overall sense of confidence? Thank you.
Well, you're absolutely right that confidence is critical. In fact, I think it's not quite true to say that this is all about confidence, but it's not all that far short of the truth to say that. And that's why I've given quite a number of speeches which are trying to say, yes, it's a serious problem, but we can manage the problem, we can come out of the other side of this, and we can get back to good growth over time. I think it's very important people don't lose confidence in that future, because if they do, then the very the responses that they make because they've lost confidence is one of the things that helps bring the weakness on. So confidence is very important, and there are at least two dimensions. I think the very first one for us was confidence in the financial system. If you lose confidence in your financial system, you're going to have a very big problem, and this was what was starting to occur in some of the major countries.
I think we can say today that, as we said, in fact, ahead of time, that the Australian financial system has come through this very strongly. They've been, by world standards, prudently managed, well regulated, they're strong, and that's a very good thing for the economy. So I think we've sustained confidence there, which is very important. The second form of confidence is just in the general business community, confidence in their own prospects for their firm, for the economy generally, for their capacity to cope with what's being thrown at them. And, you know, that's an intangible thing. There's no lever we can pull called confidence that just makes that G up. I think our job is to keep trying to explain to people what's going on in the economy, what we think is going on, what has to be done, what's being done, and where we go from here. That's part of our role, and that's why we come to occasions like today, to try to offer these explanations. When can we expect things to get better? Of course, that's the $64 billion question. And anybody who, I think, pretends to be able to be definitive about that is kidding themselves. But there will come a time when enough of the contractionary things have been absorbed and enough of us have lived through that and thought, yeah, well, I've survived, that we'll, you know, raise our eyes a little bit to the horizon and think, well, yeah, there is a future, and we can be a little bit more positive. And that time will come. I can't tell you exactly when, but it always does, and it will on this occasion. And we can speed that by running sensible policies and running all our businesses sensibly, but not too cautiously. If we all do that, then that moment will come sooner rather than later.
Tremendous. Question down this end of the room.
Thank you. My name is John O'Brien. I appreciate your coming to Townsville and giving us time. My first part of my question is in relation to your comment about our downturn being protected to some extent by holding up of exports and the fact that we actually are a very good low-cost exporter, particularly of things like coal and iron ore. With the drop in prices, are we in danger of building in inflexibilities which keep our costs high, and as things return and demand grows overseas, we'll lose market share because we don't have perhaps the financial flexibility, labour flexibility, and energy costs that reflect a leaner world? And the second question is really a bit more parochial about your focus is on the national economy, and you speak very eloquently about the national economy. Can you give us some insight into how we get recognised regionally? You know, does North Queensland actually figure as in the thinking of the Reserve Bank and yourself? Thank you.
Okay, two parts there. Which will I take first? Let me pick up the first question, the second part first. It's absolutely right that we have a national focus predominantly. Why is that? It's because Australia is a monetary union. We have one currency. We have one interest rate, or at least the Reserve Bank has one interest rate, because there's one unified financial market. And so we're setting that instrument basically driven by what is happening to the national economy, which is to say the average of all the states and the regions and the cities and the towns and so on across the country. That's what we're supposed to do, and in fact that's all we can do. So contrary to what sometimes has been claimed, we don't make monetary policy just with an eye to Sydney housing prices or whatever. We make it with an eye to the national economy
accepting that there can be quite big differences across the country and across industries, for that matter, in economic experience. We know that, and we certainly track data that is on a state or even more disaggregated basis. So it figures in that sense. But in the end, we've got a national policy instrument that we have to gear to the national economy, or, if you like, the average experience of the nation. And that means that at times, if you went back a couple of years, I think you could probably say that the rate of interest was probably too high for some people in the western suburbs of Sydney in terms of housing prices, but too low for the corresponding area in Perth. There's nothing that we can do about that other than keep in mind that there are differences and at least try to avoid exacerbating them if we possibly can. But in the end, we've got one instrument, one money, one integrated financial system, and that's where we operate. Now, are we in danger of building in inflexibilities? Well, I don't think I would pretend to tell you, as a business audience, whether things that are happening in terms of energy pricing or labour market regulation or whatever it is going to result in too much inflexibility or not. You know, you would know better than me. What is key, of course, I'm happy to say, is it's very important that we avoid a return to inflexible ways of doing things in the past and maintain the very flexibility in so many areas of the economy that's helping us get through this episode in a much better condition than we would once have done.
Okay, given the number of American dollars that the Chinese are holding at the moment, how long are they prepared to hang on to them, and what would be the implications if they decided to dump them as far as the world economy is concerned?
Another $64 billion, in fact a lot bigger than that question.
They've got a lot more than that.
It's about the $1.2 trillion question.
Yeah.
Well, I think that is going to be a big issue internationally for the next 10 years. I think that as long as China wishes to manage their exchange rate to the dollar as closely as they do, they actually haven't got a lot of choice about being prepared to hold dollars. So the choice of diversifying away from the dollar might also represent a choice about the exchange rate, which I happen personally to think in the long run is in their interest to make. But that is, of course, entirely a matter which they will decide. The other thing I guess I'd say is that talk of the dollar's demise has been around a long time. It's still, for the most part, the reserve currency of choice for most people, and that you know, the US can't assume that will always be true. But I think the change will most likely be gradual rather than rapid.
Thank you. We have a question. It would be helpful if you'd please, due to time constraints, reduce your question to one part only.
Thanks, Governor. Is that me? No. Following on from yesterday's news, Governor, there's warnings today out about unemployment from Canberra, and I'm just wanting to see from a local perspective how well are we placed to weather out the tough times ahead.
And you are? Who's asking?
Jason from Wind News, just local news here.
Well, Jason, I'm not sure I can give you a strong answer on unemployment in Townsville in particular. But I'd have thought that you're as well placed as anywhere. Diversified set of industries and keep the flexibility and the innovation. That's the best thing you can do.
Just an area that's heavily reliant on mining and industry.
I'm sorry?
Just with an area that's heavily reliant on mining and industry.
Well, the mining industry's, I'd have thought, actually got pretty good prospects in the years ahead. So I think that ought to be a cause for medium-term optimism.
Just a final question, Mr. Stevens. The banking industry, should it be more regulated now because of recent events? We've been deregulated for some time.
Well, I think we might distinguish between that question for the global banking scene and in particular countries and in Australia. I don't think that we've seen so far any evidence of significant regulatory problems here at all. In fact, I think the reverse. I think the regulatory framework seems to be standing the test very well. Internationally, the issues surround a couple of things. One is the fact that investment banks were more or less outside the regulatory net and therefore ended up taking a lot more risk than was safe either for them or for the global financial system. Now, as it turns out, it's not clear that that species of institution is going to thrive anyway in the future. A second set of questions surrounds the treatment of various things within the international capital rules, and I think some lessons have come to light out of all this. The various committees which work for years and years on tweaking these regulations are busy doing that as we speak. So I think there will be some regulatory changes of various kinds that probably will be helpful. I think it would be a mistake, though, to think that if only we just had that slightly different form of regulation, we could have avoided all this. I think that human nature being what it is, you will get financial excesses from time to time. And the question really is not how can you prevent them, because I don't think you can fully, but how do you make the system more resilient and less prone to the kind of crash that we saw when these excesses do from time to time emerge. That is a feasible goal, I think, and that's what we should be aiming for.
Yeah, we just have time for one more. Murray Cornish from the ABC. You've been standing there melting the microphone in your hand.
Well, I don't need to introduce myself now, so thank you for that. Mr. Stevens, just yesterday's GDP figures seem to have taken a few people by surprise, the government being one of them. Can you explain what effect you think that will have on your growth forecast and therefore the implications on interest rates?
Well, I'm not going to comment future interest rate decisions, and you of course expected that I would not. I guess it is worth a try, but no luck, sorry. Our people are of course evaluating the data as we sit here, and they'll be reviewing their forecasts over the next few weeks, and we'll present a new set to the board next time around. I suppose the only comment I would make about the data is that the differences between the three individual measures of GDP are unusually large in this particular quarter, which I think says that at times like this, with tremendous instability, very large relative price changes happening in the economy, the statistician has a very hard job compiling this data. That being so, I personally am reluctant to build any very strong hypothesis either way based on one quarter's figure, and we should never do that anyway. We should always take all the figures over a run of quarters and months and look at all the data, and if we do that, we'll probably get a sensible picture out of all that. So no particular comment on how it's going to affect forecasts. It doesn't seem that likely to weaken them, I suppose, one would have to say.
Thank you very much. Emma, could you bring the radio mic up to the stage for us? Thanks. Mr. Stevens, thank you very much for having a quiet chat here. It wasn't
not that quiet.
It wasn't.